Hey, what's going on? Welcome to the Mile High Five podcast. I'm Doug Cunnington, and now can I call you a co-host?
Yeah, of course.
Co-host. Mr. Money Mustache Pete, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
Thanks. It's been a long time, and I'm doing fabulous. Thanks.
Yeah, we got a little busy sort of at the tail end of summer. Like, I had some trips going. I think you did as well, but I haven't seen you in probably several weeks or something like that, right?
Yeah, and which is in general a good thing, making the most of Colorado summer.
Yeah. Any highlights, any specific trips that you did?
For me, it's been not so much trip-oriented as I kind of got my construction mojo back, and I did this bathroom renovation in my house that was like 6 years overdue. So for most of a month, kind of September was the main time I did this. I was like just hardcore grinding and cutting and demolishing and rebuilding and plumbing. And it was really, really fun. And now it's done and I'm kind of proud. It's like the nicest bathroom I've built so far out of maybe 25 in my life. Nice. And I'm just enjoying it and then doing smaller things and then planning some trips now.
Gotcha. And that is your happy place, like the construction and like the planning and then the little hurdles that there's always surprises, right?
Yeah. And it's just like a way to spend, for me, like 12 hours straight in like this meditative, highly physical, but highly mental spot where I'm not distracted by anything. I'm just like walking around and carrying stuff and solving problems and listening to really good music the whole time.
Yeah.
And I just love those kind of days sometimes because they help remind me, like, it just helps calm me down and turn me into a productive creator. I like creating things. That's my favorite thing to do. I like the word creativity, and construction is how I express my creativity the most, I think.
Very cool. And it gets, I mean, part of it's an art in the design portion, but then there's like the, I guess, the more analytical and like numbers and the measuring and like the exactness of it all. So it's a good marriage of all those things that you like to do.
Yeah, very much. And it's like just so good for your body because it's normally hard to keep yourself moving for 8 to 12 hours of physical stuff. And sometimes I forget to eat, which is a good thing. You know, you're kind of going into this hunter-gatherer fasting mode where your body's just running on, you know, all of its stored fat and feeling incredibly sharp and lean and healthy. Mm. And so you can't get that from writing blog posts.
Very good. All right. We have a ton to cover today. I'm not sure if we're going to get to it all. We had a couple questions left over from the last mailbag that we'll hit. Those are quick hitters. And we're going to talk about some bigger topics that may expand out into multiple episodes in the future. So one is the good life algorithm versus the badassity checklist.
Yeah.
Okay. So these are both great things, and I'll explain the good life algorithm, which people may recognize from Cal Newport, and we'll back into it. We'll also talk about identity when you quit your job or when you're having like a life change, because it comes up all the time in interviews that I do or side conversations where someone is either about to quit their job, they already have, or they quit their job and retired and then went back to work. So I think that this identity piece is a really important area to talk about. And we're not going to solve the problem, but we'll talk about all our journey and maybe tips we have for people.
Yeah.
And there's another question / sort of idea that we may be able to get to, and I'll generalize it, but the main idea is when people are either FI or very close, maybe they hit a Coast FI number, and then they dread their job and what to do. So we'll see if we get to it. Again, all of these could be like their full own episode. So with that said, Pete, can you explain your badassity checklist, and then I'll explain the good life algorithm and what we can, you know, learn from the two. But yeah, what's your checklist about? Yeah. We'll put a link so people can actually go check it out.
Yeah. Well, this started a long time ago. I did a blog post a year or two ago about how I was getting into health podcasts like the Huberman Lab, where they talk about all these different things. Like he's big on get sunlight into your eyes early in the day so you can set your circadian rhythm properly and do a bunch of natural stuff and don't get distracted. And by watching and listening to like hundreds of episodes of that podcast and other ones, I realized that you can boil it down to a bunch of daily behaviors. So I just made it into a little chart and I put it like into a spreadsheet, but really it's just blank boxes that you can check for each day. Mm-hmm. And so then I dug that concept back out for a recent blog post to say, like, this is what I do to keep myself on track with daily habits. And the basic idea is it's like a bunch of grids from, so you can print one out each month, like the 1st of September, September 2nd, September 3rd. And then on the vertical direction, there's like the first thing on the thing is no phone upon waking, right? After, and if I succeed in doing that, like you don't roll over and start checking your phone when you wake up, then you earn a checkbox. You check that thing off. And the next thing is morning light upon, go straight outside when I wake up if it's light. And then if I do that, I check the box. And then there's maybe 20 things throughout the day. Like it includes like salad for lunch, do at least some kind of weight training today, alcohol free day, right? So you don't always get that checkbox, but your goal is to get it most of the time. And if I follow most of those things, and then you can like over the course of a month, you have like this whole thing, preferably on your fridge, and you've colored most of the boxes in. And if you check most of the boxes, you tend to have a really good day almost every day. Mm-hmm. So it's very mechanical and methodical, but it's a way of keeping yourself on track simple. If like me, you can be prone to distractions and getting into bad habits just without thinking about it.
Yep. Very good. So habit tracking, you got some good stuff and you look at it kind of on a daily basis. And do you literally like fill in on it? Do you do this habit tracking each day?
Well, no. Okay. That's one thing I should. It's like, okay, that's one habit that I haven't fully built is sometimes I forget and then I see the thing. I'm like, oh yeah, what did I do Wednesday? And I'm like trying to color in the boxes. But part of that is actually a good sign because by default, I do almost all those things every day now. Mm-hmm. And my days are so good that I don't really need to work on them.
Right.
So the Badassity tracker, as I call it, is more like a tool waiting for me if I start to stumble and I'm not doing very well. I'm like, you know what? Let's put this thing on the kitchen table and be more formal about it and get back on track. So it's still helping me even if I'm not coloring in the boxes each day.
Right.
Initially, I was coloring it in for several months and it was reminding me what to do each day. But now I feel like I've internalized a lot of those things. And there's a few different factors that have gotten better in my life recently, but it's in general, it's been a lot of really good days and very few, you know, wasted or bad days. And that's really all you can ask for a good life.
Well said. And I think Elizabeth and I are very happy too. We actually like, we're like blown away. We're like, what a great day. Like we have added some social stuff and other things and like healthy and workout and get the sunlight and like mental stimulation, all the things that are in the checklist. But I think similar, like we've set up our lives and habits. So it's like pretty easy to stay on track most of the time. It's like the alcohol thing, I messed that up. I need to not have so much beer readily available. But it's really cool that like you got into the habit and then you don't need to track it as much because you just by default are doing most of the stuff most of the time, which is, I mean, you don't have to be perfect, just most of the stuff most of the time.
That's how the human body works and mind is like, it's an average. It's a running average of your past behavior is what leads you to how your life is and how you feel and your health for the most part too.
So the Good Life algorithm is, I'll give the history, but I don't want to go too deep into the origin. So Cal Newport, he covers it in some of his books and podcasts. He referenced Tim Ferriss in his podcast where he interviewed the author Jim Collins, and people can go research that. Jim Collins had sort of like a tracking spreadsheet.
We should clarify that it's not our Jim Collins in the fire world who goes by J.L. Collins, but
correct,
a different business and life author named Jim Collins.
Thank you. Yes. Different guy than J.L. So the spreadsheet, because Jim Collins is an author, I think he tracked like how many words he wrote and maybe like a sentence of activity and like a couple different categories. I don't remember. It doesn't really matter too much, but what he did was ranked sort of a 5-interval scale. It was -2, -1, 0, 1, and 2. So it's like neutral, good, bad. And like, it's not super granular, but it gives them an idea. And the main idea is that there's a feedback loop. So you can go back and see, similar to your habit tracking, Pete, So you could see, oh, I didn't check most of these boxes, or I missed this one and I wasn't as happy, or I had like a bad week or something like that. So Jim Collins can go back and see like, oh, I was productive, but I actually didn't have a great day. And maybe he could figure out like based on what activity he did that day, he was like, oh, I was traveling. So it was kind of a rougher day. So maybe in the future, he's like, I don't want to travel quite as much. And this feedback loop, I think, can be really helpful, especially when people are retiring or there's some change in their lifestyle or location or whatever, but there's a FI podcast. So maybe you've retired and you're thinking, you have an impression in your head of like what your life's going to be like and the activities that might make you happy. We're bad at estimating like how happy it'll make us or if we're going to like it or not. So maybe you try things out and you realize like, oh, I don't like cooking as much as I thought, and I need to find a different activity. So you can take this feedback that you're giving yourself and adjust along the way. So I have a couple things that hit me, but I'll pause here. And does this system make sense to you? Are there things that you like? What do you not like about this sort of feedback?
It would help if I read the actual guy's book or at least a chapter that explains how this works, but it sounds pretty similar. Mm-hmm. It's a way of checking in with yourself and seeing which activities make you happy. I would argue that adding like a little bit of a science component. So instead of just blindly stumbling through and deciding what might make you happy from that, instead just understanding what makes most humans happy, which is like the physical activity thing and the being outside thing and socializing with other people and being creative, those things are like almost guaranteed to help almost everybody. So if you start with those things and then continue with the -2 to +2 system, you might get where you're going a little sooner. But yeah, that's a good, like the example you give of people who stumble into retirement, like work a long career and then just quit. And that's notoriously like that leads to trouble for some people. And it's because they're trying things that aren't necessarily going to be all that fun. Like staying at home to relax and watch TV, like that's fun for like a day. And then you're going to start having trouble immediately because you're not doing any of the things that are good for human beings. And even travel, it's a mixed bag because you have some things like you have novelty and exploration, which is good for your brain and exciting. But usually it's very bad for you physically. Like the act of traveling is almost always terrible, right? You're getting crammed into the seats of like different conveyances. So it's hard to recover from that without feeling worse. So, and a lot of people don't have like a physical fitness routine that they're doing while they're traveling. Like at best, they'll walk around the streets of a city a lot, but that's not really taking care of your whole body. So there's like a downside from that. And then what are you creating and helping when you're traveling? If you're just consuming and going to museums and stuff, you're not actually creating. And so for many people, that's going to leave a void. So it would totally explain why some people retire to travel in quotation marks and then aren't completely satisfied with that lifestyle.
Right. Adds a lot of stress. And I just interviewed someone recently, Monica, and some people like they thrive on the travel and they figure out the health aspects that usually give people trouble.
Yeah.
But I think she said she travels maybe like 50% of the time. And that's a lot to me, but there are different ways to do it so that you limit the downside, the negative health aspects. And she seems very healthy. So, okay. I had a couple observations on this feedback loop, and I think I've internalized it because I don't use this good life tracking system or your checklist, but I think I am very thoughtful on if I'm annoyed. So I think I'm happy most of the time. So I think I'm very aware when I'm like, oh, I fucked up on that and I need to figure it out. So I'm going to give you a couple of examples. One of them is not like it wasn't a mistake on my issue, and you may have some advice for me. So I mentioned to you that I had a little bit of a social overload. So there's been a lot of just social activities, parties, stuff like that. Pretty fun. I mean, it's fun stuff. I enjoy it when I'm there. But one thing that I realized, and maybe it spanned back to all the way, maybe like Camp Fi, where there's a lot of small talk. And I'm like, I'm so fucking bored of small talk. And like some of it is necessary. When you first meet someone, you have to like do the dance, right? And like go back and forth and get to know each other better. So like I realize some small talk is necessary, but it's been constant where it's just like, oh, what have you been up to? Mm-hmm. And then it's like, okay, I can hit some trips. Like I could tell stories, right? So I'm like, okay, did some trips, here's some highlights. But I was getting kind of bored telling the same stories to different people over and over again. And happens at conferences too. It's like, oh, I haven't seen you in a year. What have you been up to? And I'm like, I don't want to tell the same fucking story again. So I would like change the highlights. So sometimes I would tell different stories to different people, but I was bored of small talk. Do you have any tips for me on this?
I think your approach is right, which is just limiting the number of activities you do where you have to do that because it's not your thing. And some people are better at it and they enjoy it more. And everyone has a different idea of what's a fun conversation.
Right.
But it's totally okay to know your limits and seek it out. Like some people just like fewer but deeper friendships where you don't have to do the small talk because you just pick up where you left off last time in deep conversations and have common interests. Like to me, I like talking about subjects that are like, you know, affecting the whole humanity and stuff, these big subjects. So a small talk, much like you, it takes a lot of energy to try to be fun making small talk. And as a result, I just don't have to, you know, there's so much, you don't have to do everything in life. There's always going to be too many options with your time. So pick the right amount and see how it goes.
Okay. Thank you. That is helpful. And I was going to say that's like, it's a plug for podcasting, by the way, because like we could jump in. You and I have had many conversations and spent hours together, but like we could jump in, hit these like harder topics that impact humanity or we're trying to figure something out.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's pretty fun. So plug for podcasting because it kind of gives you a format and structure to be able to do it because sometimes it's a little tougher just in general. So podcasting, it's cool for that.
Yeah, it's true. It is a really fun way to make your conversations long and be more purposeful about them. And it's the same reason I don't do normal news interviews where you have like 3 minutes and they ask the same questions like, how did you come up with the name Mr. Money Mustache? And like, what are three ways that people can get out of debt? And like, it's just no fun to answer those questions for the 500th time.
Yeah.
So instead, I just don't even do it. And then I don't have to be frustrated.
Do you get requests fairly often?
In the old days, I did. Yeah. Still a few every now and then, but for the most part, the whole like fire movement is just broadened like an ocean and I'm just one of these little particles in the ocean. And that's kind of nice. You know, I can just participate when I want to.
It's cool.
I'm doing an interview but it's a written one because that's the kind I like for like a Canadian newspaper, the Globe and Mail later today.
Oh, cool.
But it's actually one of us on the inside. There's like a fire. Do you know Christian Bryce, the Canadian fire, you know,
commentators? I know of them. Yeah.
They go on a lot of trips as well that we've been on in the same sometimes. But anyway, he got a little like side gig writing fire-related articles for Canada's biggest newspaper. The Globe and Mail is kind of like the New York Times of Canada.
Yeah.
And so every week, it's like he describes it as like a little bit of propaganda because he's like interviewing or writing stories about early retirement and financial independence, but in a positive way, which is the opposite of what mainstream media usually does for us, where they're like, look at these poor people who are making sacrifices and penny pinching.
Yeah.
And he's like, no, it's great. It's actually rich people who are having lots of fun and not at the office like you. So this is why it's good.
All right. I'll share one more. And I think it could be more applicable. And I will actually be taking action on this. So in the last week, I had some activities that forced me to eat dinner a little bit later. And I love to cook. And basically, I got home a little later than expected. And it was all stress brought on by myself and my own choices and activities, but I didn't realize that it was going to like stress me out a little bit and then impact my sleep because eating later in the day like definitely impacts my sleep.
Yeah, that's a good thing for everybody to know. Don't eat anything after 7 p.m.
Right.
And even when you're hungry, just embrace that and then you'll have better sleep and you'll be healthier.
You're going to be okay. In fact, I had like a late lunch at like 3 and I skipped dinner. And I was like, this is great. Like I wasn't hungry and I didn't eat just out of habit.
Yeah.
So it's like the Gremlin rules, you know, don't eat after midnight. Mm-hmm. So I love that movie. I saw it way too young. I think it was like rated R and I saw it when I was like 5 or whatever.
It was scary for me too.
So basically, I know that sometimes I will have a later dinner or go to bed later, and it's like conferences or maybe it's a special occasion or something like that. And like my expectations are I'm going to eat later, I'll be up later, and like I prepare for it. But on these random days, I got to bed later, I didn't sleep as well. And I was like, this is stressing me out like for a few hours and it's impacting my sleep. So I'm like, I need to guard for this and make sure I know, like, if I do something, is it going to impact my meal and when I eat? So I'm taking that feedback directly, and it happened twice in maybe 10 days or something like that. So here's an instance where I observed that it wasn't working out, and now I need to make sure that I protect this thing, which I realize is now important to me, and that's eating at like 6 or 5. Mm-hmm. I eat very early. So yeah. Any feedback or observations on that?
Well, it sounds like kind of an isolated life observation, but I mean, correct. I'm certainly all for it. In fact, yeah. I'd learned about fasting many years ago because of like blog readers telling me about it. Initially, I thought it was a terrible idea until I read more. I'm like, oh, the human body likes fasting sometimes.
Yeah.
And then I recently had to do it for almost 2 days because of this colonoscopy, turning 50, I had to get this medical test done where they need you to be totally empty. You come in like an empty balloon of a human.
Right.
So I was initially like dreading it because I like food so much. But I just followed the instructions, and everyone else has already done it in our friend group. So I was like, oh, if they can do it, I can do it. And sure enough, other than the fact that I craved food because I emotionally love eating, my body very quickly adapted to being in fasting mode. And then it was just like running off of stored fat and ketones and stuff. And so I wasn't even hungry. I was just like this hunter, super alert and feeling like light and lean.
Yeah.
And I thought, this isn't so bad at all. I should not be afraid of not eating. So when you carry that idea, like 2 days of not eating, like you skip breakfast, you skip lunch, you skip dinner, you go to bed, next day you don't have breakfast. Like it's such a long time. The idea of not eating a late bedtime snack seems so easy by comparison.
Totally.
And if you go to bed hungry, that's really good for you because you're extending that little overnight fast that you're doing, and you're going to wake up with a lot of stuff, you know, cleaned out of your system and burned off, and you'll have a healthy next day. And unless you're already like perilously lean, most of us could afford to lose like at least a couple pounds of fat. And that's exactly what happens when you don't eat late, is your body eats fat for your sleeping, and clean does a bunch of cell housekeeping as well. And it's good for you. So
nice. Yeah,
that can be the one nugget of usefulness. People, if they get one useful thing from this episode, they should try eating an early dinner and no snacks and see what happens.
Yeah. Yeah. And quick note on the colonoscopy. I found that I was going to ask a different question. I woke up during it and they told me, hey, you may wake up and we'll just give you more of the juice, you know? Did you wake up during yours?
No, I actually only right at the end. And right as I said, okay, we're done. That was great. And I was like, so they really timed that perfectly with a perfect dose.
Yeah.
Of propofol was the name of the drug. It was just crazy because I'm, you know, not being an intravenous drugs user, it was fun to just see an IV in your arm, and I'm perfectly conscious. And the guy goes, okay, we're going to have a little nap now. And he goes, whoosh. And I was looking at the clock and I looked at my watch. I'm like, it's so weird to think that I'm conscious and I'm going to be asleep within 10 seconds. And then it was like someone was pushing a pillow on my head. And then I woke up exactly like 25 minutes later and felt like nothing had happened. It was like magic.
So interesting. Yeah. So I woke up and they had it on like a big screen TV. Did they do that on yours
too? I don't know. I was asleep.
It was so, well, they had it in there. I guess that's how they look. Yeah. And it was a TV in the room, the procedure room, not like out in the lobby where they're like, oh, here's what we're doing in here.
Yeah. H50.
Yeah.
It's like on a billboard outside the building, so people driving by.
Yeah. It's like, here's what's going on in here. So I woke up. And what I wanted to ask was, hey, I have a YouTube channel. Can I get this video? Because I thought it would be funny. I'm sure I just like gargled and drooled and didn't say any words. And then they were like, get this guy down again. But yeah, I tried to say like, hey, give me this video. I'm going to put it on YouTube. But they never acknowledged it. Oh. And then I was like, they gave me I don't know all the drugs, but fentanyl was one of them. And I don't remember shit for like 4 hours, like afterwards.
Oh, I didn't have that.
Okay.
Yeah, I was just normal after.
Yeah. So I didn't know until afterwards, but yeah, apparently I had conversations and it was quite an experience. So The real question that I was going to ask, but I'm glad we got into that, 36 hours in, so I fasted for 48 hours, maybe a couple times. About 36 hours in, I was cold, and it happened to coincide at night, but I'm usually hot almost all the time. Very unusual for me to feel cold. Did you have any difference in like how you interpret temperature or anything like that after some time?
I think my system did slow down. So like I didn't have that. I'm usually too hot, burning off energy. I had like a very calm, but also just like I was less motivated. I was kind of just in this chill mode because I was also like not drinking as much coffee as I normally would.
Right.
And other things that make you perk up throughout the day that just weren't happening as much. So I was happy, but I wouldn't want to be fasted all the time. You know, it was more like going on a meditation journey for 2 days. And then when I got back, like first thing I did is eat like 2000 calories of greasy, spicy food. And then I was like, we're back, baby. And it's been like that ever since.
Yeah, I think I had a burrito. I had like a giant burrito and I was like, I feel good. I feel real good.
Right.
So, okay. Yeah. And people get colonoscopies. Don't put it off. It's not that bad.
Oh yeah. That's a good thing. If you were worrying about this, like I was, it's totally like the hardest part is just not eating, and you can turn that into a positive thing. And then everything about the procedure is oddly pleasant. They treat you well. You don't have any, nothing happens that you're conscious for, preferably. Mm-hmm. But even if you were, like people do non-sedated colonoscopies and they're fine with it too. I would just prefer to, I just like the idea of getting knocked out.
Most people do that. Okay, very good. And let's transition to the next topic here. So identity when you quit your job. So a lot of people struggle with this, and quick little example, maybe someone's like a successful IT director, or they're a doctor or a lawyer, and they really take pride in their career and their job, and they've worked at it for years, their whole social network, there's a lot of social capital built up. And then all of a sudden they retire. They go to no work and retirement, and they struggle. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. Now I'm curious, when you stopped working now many years ago, did you have any sort of identity crisis going from, you know, software engineer to
stay-at-home dad? That's my primary job. Okay. And then stay-at-home dad. Part-time carpenter.
Yeah. How'd you deal with that shift?
Well, for me, it was really easy because first of all, I was only 30. So I hadn't like been working all that long. So my world hadn't wired up around the idea of being a software engineer. I wasn't a particularly important one. And actually my job wasn't all that fun. I was at a big company just doing like little parts of a giant product. And my coworkers weren't all that into the company either. So that actually made it a lot easier to quit. Mm-hmm. It would be quite different if I was like the mayor of a small town and everybody loved each other, and I was like, my identity was defined as doing this job, even if I worked hard. In fact, and that's the kind of job you don't always have to quit. Maybe you could just scale back or integrate it with other parts of your life better. So it's really a slippery slope and a complicated situation. Like you have to think of it on a case by case basis. I should do a blog post more about this because I feel like there's so much to say. In my coaching that I do occasionally now, I find it's more of a worst of both worlds situations. Like, so someone has a job, they've been doing it for 25 years, they don't like it, but they still feel bonded to it just because they're in the habit of doing it. But it's like, they don't really like it. So that's the real tricky thing, because they should quit. It's going to be best for them. But they might have let the rest of their life fall away a little bit too much because they've been working so hard in this job. So they don't have something to retire to. They just have something they should retire from. Mm-hmm. So I would just encourage people to think about it right now and make sure you're building up the rest of your life and keeping it as vibrant as possible, and keep the employment part of your life small and continue to shrink it. Mm-hmm. And I've always been against people dividing themselves from their career. There's some people who should do that. But for anybody, for example, wants to be a parent, your career should already be second choice. Otherwise, there's going to be all these conflicts between being a good parent and being a good employee or boss or whatever. Mm-hmm. So just like, yeah, let don't let the career become your identity if you can avoid it.
What would you describe your identity as now?
That's a funny question. I don't really think of a fixed word for my identity. I'm just me. I'm just a guy who likes to do a bunch of little experimental fun things in life with other people. And it's very people-based. And I guess the main change, though, is like for the last almost 20 years, I've defined myself as a dad to my son, right? Mm-hmm. And family man. But I just kind of, that's faded out as my son has gotten older. And now it's just, you know, he's an independent guy. So he's almost more like a part-time roommate. Like we've still visits with his two parents separately, you know, most of the time. And I love having him around, but he doesn't need me to the extent that a kid would. So I've broadened out to become more engaged with other friends and my own interests and everything. And I'm just like a free human being. That's my main identity, is I'm free. So I get to decide what I want to do throughout life. And it's a lot of interesting stuff to me.
Yeah. That makes me feel good. So I didn't tell you what I wrote over here. In fact, I was so lazy and unprepared today. I didn't even send you notes ahead of time. So, I mean, I'm living this lazy lifestyle very much, but it comes into play. So I'll explain my identities as it shifted over time. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe somewhat similar to you, I had, what was your degree in again?
Engineering.
Okay. So yeah, computer engineering. So kind of identity there. My first job was consulting, and then I kind of narrowed down into project management. And then when I got laid off, I was like online entrepreneur. And I think I was really proud of that and like making that work, and slowly like backed away. I think maybe some influence from you and other folks where, you know, I heard the interview on Tim Ferriss in 2017, and I'm like, you know what? I don't need to keep growing. If I stay at this level where it's a good balance and interesting, I could stay here for a few years and then I could ramp down. So I've ramped down, and then I ended up getting into YouTube and podcasting. And for a little stretch, I think I really identified as like podcaster, but it's tricky, just like with a job. If I really get into the metrics and the analytics and I'm like, this show is growing and I get the numbers and likes and all that stuff, it's a double-edged sword. So if I was like letting that feed my ego, then if it drops, then that would make me sad and I don't want that. So I kind of backed away. So I separated my happiness away from, you know, money in some ways and raises and jobs and all that. But I also got away from the analytics because that's a dangerous area to be in.
I don't look at the analytics from my website for many years either. I don't even know how to check them anymore because the one way I used to check them kind of broke.
Yeah.
And that's a good thing. You know, I just type shit into the computer when I feel like it. And I enjoy feedback from people, like writing back and forth. But that's the extent of the Mr. Money Mustache thing.
Perfect. And then the final thing that I wrote, this is why I'm happy. I wrote freedom because I'm not identifying as a specific thing other than like I'm a person who has free time to do other stuff, whether it's like some travel, spend time with family, build deeper relationships with my friends, which is an area like I'm trying to spend more time on, like intentionally, like set aside the time to like spend time with people.
Yeah.
But it comes down to like the freedom thing, which is a vague idea, especially when someone's like, how do you identify as like a professional or something? It's like you and I, we have to tread lightly because if we say, we're free human beings, we sound like crazy people.
You know? Yeah. And we don't want to insult people who might not consider themselves free.
Yeah. So it's interesting. That said, I mean, do you think about identity in the same way that maybe we used to when we had jobs, if you could remember that far back?
I don't think I ever thought of it that way, but I do have a slightly better answer now that I heard your answer, which was really good. So I guess I think of myself as, number one, I want to be like a kind and useful human being. So kind of that's what I get motivated by and how I like to feel about myself and behave in a way that is consistent with that. And then I also like to think of myself as maybe a student of all fields and a student of life. Because one of the things that I notice is maybe different in me than some other people, maybe a bit unusual, is that I'm curious about all subjects and I really want to know how everything works And if there's anything I don't know how it works, it actually annoys me. It's like, why is the train that way? Or why is the schedule this way? Or why is the government doing this and that? To me, I prefer to just know everything, which I know is impossible, but I still like, it drives me to continue to look into how things work. So I do have a reasonable idea of how most things work, which is why sometimes my friends call me encyclopedia, because like they'll ask me questions and I'll have these weird, like arcane bits of knowledge about like, why are the train tracks built this way? Or
yeah,
how does this computer thing work? Well, it's because it started back in 1971. But anyway, so I like to be, that's my favorite thing, is curiosity.
Yeah.
And that's what makes me interested throughout each day, is the chance to keep learning about stuff in all the different fields.
And I hear from people that say, I don't know what I would do if I retired. Like they don't get it. But I think like a lot of us just have like this curiosity where we want to learn, we go deep. Like I'm like doing a lot of research on guitar pickups currently. And like, I'm like, oh, I'm going to upgrade pickups. And I took a handful of double E classes, but it's been 25 years since I soldered anything. But I'm like, oh, I know this stuff. Like I want to get into it. And there's so many rabbit holes you can go into. Is there anything you're obsessed with, something new in the last couple months or something where you were like, I want to learn about that. And then you like, you went really deep and learned everything about it.
I'm not really, I'm more like a broad, like I learned small amounts about lots of things.
Okay.
But I'm still always interested. So I always describe my life as doing a series of science experiments. Like everything's an experiment. And so I'm in my garage workshop a lot, just making things and fixing things. And so if something breaks, then that's like an automatic project. Oh, you got to figure out how this thing works so you can fix it.
Yep.
But I'm always doing things with, you know, like I'm really interested in solar power, for example. So I have all these solar panels scattered around my property, like generating power, and I'm doing stuff with the power and heating the hot tub and finding new ways to make that automatic, and just like random stuff that's totally not creating any economic value, but it's helping me learn and have fun. So I'm like a kid with a giant Lego set.
Yeah. Specifically on the solar, are you storing, do you have a battery bank or is it just like real-time usage?
Yeah, that's a future project. And I do watch a lot of occasional YouTube videos on the batteries that you get for your house, because it's all cheap and easy nowadays. I haven't gotten that far, partly because I'm thinking of moving to a new house within the next year. So I don't want to build up something that's not going to be interesting to whoever buys my house from me. I want to put it into more of like a permanent residence if I'm going to do that. Gotcha. So a lot of my, you know, my experiments are temporary in nature for now. And then the stuff that I do actually change in my house, I try to make it like fixing the bathroom. Everyone's going to enjoy that rather than only certain people care about solar panels that make your hot tub automatically hot.
Are you a bidet person? Carl was a big proponent of bidets.
In principle, I know totally like bidet is a religion. And if you're not part of, you know, if you meet a bidet religious person, like even the word toilet paper is like sin. It's like a curse word. And I don't live that way in my own life, but I totally get it. Yeah. I've tried them. Okay. I'm in favor of the idea. It just hasn't totally caught on.
Okay. Yeah. Carl is a bit of a bidet missionary.
Yeah.
Actually, we should make t-shirts, put like a toilet on there. He's like a bidet missionary.
Yeah.
All right. We'll have to workshop this. Maybe we could have him sitting on the toilet in this t-shirt. Actually, that'll be like, maybe we'll put that on the store for my hi-fi.
Yeah. It's much like veganism, where people who convert to being a vegan, like they want to spread the news and it's like sinful to not be a vegan. Not everybody, but like it happens. And I think bidet is kind of the same thing.
Okay. So slightly back on topic, do you have any tips for people that are thinking of, let me rephrase that. Do you have any tips for people that will have to figure out their identity? Maybe they're retiring soon. Maybe they've already retired and they're like, I was a lawyer before. And now when people ask me, I'm not sure what to say. And of course the psychological thing of like shifting.
Yeah.
Just in general. So what tips do you have?
I mean, it's fun to observe your feelings. And I actually remember when I first quit from being an engineer, for the first little while, I would still say engineer because I felt like a little bit uncomfortable or maybe even ashamed about saying like, oh yeah, I'm a carpenter or like just a dad or whatever. But then later that switched in the opposite way. And now I don't even think of mentioning that I used to be an engineer. And now I'm proudly, I'll just say like, yeah, I'm a carpenter or I'm, you know, I used to say mostly a stay-at-home dad, but now that's not accurate anymore. So I do tend to just use, I define myself an occupation, I would just say like I'm a house builder or a carpenter. Okay. If somebody needs the simple answer.
Right.
I mean, really, I guess for a while I was more of a blogger than I was a carpenter, but now it's switched. It's, okay. You don't really have to have a good answer. It's more like just an excuse to start a conversation.
Right.
So I think the main thing you should do if you want to have an identity that you can share with people is think like, what's interesting about yourself that you enjoy talking about? And then package that up as your answer when people ask you. And that way you can give that answer and then it invites a fun conversation.
Right.
And like, I don't mind saying I'm retired because that, if it's somebody that I want to get to know better, that opens up this whole can of worms of interesting conversation right there. Mm-hmm.
Yep. And it's definitely a piece of knowing your audience and who you're talking to in the conversation you may or may not want to have.
Yeah.
You can kind of guide it in that right. way. So one tip that you mentioned before, and I'll just cue you up, and this is something Elizabeth did. I think Carl has recommended it, where you kind of slowly do less work. And I literally did it in my own, I'm self-employed, but I slowly did that. And it helped me disconnect in a slow, gradual way. And I think you have a story where someone has basically changed the scope of how much they work.
I don't remember the story you're talking about, but in general, everything is good. And again, it goes back to thinking of it as an experiment. If you've been working a lot and you want to make a change, you don't have to quit totally. You can scale back. And a lot of people think that their boss or their company won't be able to survive without them, or they won't be allowed to scale back. But that's usually incorrect. It's just like the whole limiting beliefs thing. Once you ask or say, I'm doing this, then suddenly, sometimes it happens in a positive way. Like your company is like, well, we're going to have to double your salary then and give you this less scat, you know, because you're obviously so important that you can make these calls. So they suddenly respect you more. Much like in Office Space, when Peter decided he didn't like the job anymore and he starts like slacking off, then everyone's like, oh, we're looking at you for a management position now. And he gets more respect. And then he still quit, which I like how he ends up doing construction, just like yeah. this Peter. That's one of the reasons that movie speaks to my heart so well.
It's one of my favorites. Yeah.
But yeah, why not scale back and then see what happens in your free time as you do scale back? And I think for people with kids, like your parenting role will automatically grow in a really nice way to suck up that extra time. And everybody I know who's done that while they're still in the parenting years of their life, they've been incredibly glad. They're like, wow, I can't believe I was wasting so much time and giving it to my employer. And my kids were not getting this time with me. And I had to schedule them into all these other activities and childcare because I wasn't around. And suddenly they can suck up your time in a good way. And then that might make it so you're ready to quit the rest of the job because you realize it's just getting in the way of the stuff you actually want to do.
Right. And that's almost, I feel like that's what Carl realized, like his weekend activities grew. And then eventually it was like, oh yeah, like I would much rather be doing this other stuff.
Yeah.
So one thing that I noted here is people also have the tendency to want to be productive. We were probably raised with that, like, hey, like do hard work and be productive. And then when we get a job, you equate that hard work to money. So all of a sudden we short circuit some circuit in our brain and we yeah. forget that there are other ways that we can be productive. And it may not look productive from the outside. I think this is where people worry about being judged. And maybe I think yeah. I've gotten over that. I don't care. It looks like we have free time because we do, but like people neglect health and fitness and diet and relationships. And those activities are productive, but they don't look productive and it won't show up like directly in your bank account usually. Yeah. What do you think of this? Those productive activities that don't look productive?
Yeah. Those are the fabric of my daily life, really. Like I really get into just doing laundry, for example, because it's, you know, it's a sunny day. You wake up, sun like comes up in the sky. And then I think this is the perfect day for some laundry. And then yeah. I just, you know, like gather this clothes from everything, things that need washing in the house, run the washing machine. And then I meticulously, like I enjoy spreading it out on the clothesline just mm-hmm. right to catch the sun. And I'm out there. And that leads to some other projects. I'm like, oh yeah, there's that welding project that I was only half finished. All right, as soon as I hang up these clothes, I'm going to go over and finish that because my workshop is in my driveway next to the clothesline. And it's just like a natural day of what I like to imagine prehistoric people would have done too. They just get up and they deal with like getting food, taking care of the camp, maybe work on your dwelling. If you need a structure, you'll work on your house more, like invent some new tools. So it's all kind of just tinkering. And if you have that with loved ones around as well, like, you know, maybe your family's inside and you go inside and cook lunch for everybody. And eventually you have to go out and get food. And for me, that just means like biking over to Sam's Club. In more badass times, it would mean going out to hunt and gather. But those are productive, even though you're not getting paid for them. And you can fill up a whole day with that very happily. And then very quickly, the idea of a job just seems like a ridiculous distraction from these real things that matter and that are fun.
And yeah, I totally agree. I didn't know. That was a good laundry story. I was like, where's this going? So you drive. The thing is, we're in Colorado here. It's often very sunny and windy. I bet your clothes dry like very fast, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's here. A year-round outdoor laundry climate, which I love. As long as you know, there's certain days you can't do it, but it's like, you know, 300 of the days, it's good.
It's pretty good.
So yeah, I'm passionate about laundry.
Yeah. Well, I know, like, we're from the Atlanta, Georgia area, humid all the time, a lot more rain. And I'm curious, do you have any experience in drying your laundry outside in a much more humid and climate?
I mean, I grew up in Ontario,
right,
Canada, in the Great Lakes, and my mom still lives there and my brother, and they still line dry the clothes. You just have to be a bit more discerning. Mm-hmm. Like sometimes you just can't do it. You have to use the electric clothes dryer, no big deal. Yeah. But when it is sunny, the key is that the sun has to strike your clothing in the humid climates. Because like, even if it's humid, it'll dry if the sun hitting it. If it's humid and cloudy, then no, it won't dry.
Okay.
No big deal.
It's just normal stuff. Okay.
Yeah.
The other thing that we could pick the activities that we like to do. So you really dig laundry, respect that. I like cooking and shopping for food. Yeah, you like cooking too, but like I can cook for several hours in a day and I'm like, this is great. And to your point, I'm like, I would much rather whatever, break down this chicken and cook some stuff than
do laundry. Because if so, we make the perfect couple. You can cook for me. I'll take care of your clothing. We'll both be happy.
Yeah. All right. We'll see how it works out.
I can
out.
Do the maintenance too.
Yeah. Actually, it is and then we could play music when we're done with our chores.
Very romantic.
Yeah. All right. We could do a summer trip or something like that. Okay. We'll come back
to that. Remember there was a big guys trip last summer.
Yeah. We got to get that.
Nobody was doing laundry, but there was like lots of pickleball and climbing a 14er mountain and stuff.
It was awesome. And actually, this is one area we could highlight the finer points of like keeping your relationships, like nurturing them, I guess. So especially, we may have hit this theme before, but like guys our age, like we're not prone to like try to hang out with our guy friends, but it's so important for us to have like those deeper relationships. And Brad Barrett put together a trip. I think there were like 8 of us or so. And it's a big commitment. It's a sacrifice. People traveled from all over the country to come hang out. And it's so tough to plan that like we didn't do it this past year because like we got a little busy. No one spearheaded it. Like Brad, thanks for doing that. But
yeah.
Do you have any other trips like that planned upcoming? Or are you thinking about those?
Yeah, I have a pretty good one. So it has a smaller number of people, but I get to go to Colombia for the first time at the end of this year, like beginning of January.
Nice.
Wrapping around the new year, because our mutual friends, the Donegans, are regulars in Colombia. So I heard about that, over the past year. And I said, can I join your trip this year and just like chip in and we can get a bigger Airbnb together? And they said, sure. So now it's going to happen. So it's going to be similar to that Breckenridge trip that we took, but with just different people. Its core is going to be built around just like two couples there. But then lots of visitors are going to be around at the same time. So I think it'll be pretty social.
Very awesome. How many days are you going?
I think it's around 10.
Okay. Is that like a sweet spot for that sort of travel? It's kind of far away. So you have to take into account the travel days or whatever.
Yeah. So we'll see. I mean, I've been to Ecuador a few times and I typically go for 2 weeks for those trips in the past. And it was always kind of nice. It's immersive enough that I forget that I live in the United States. And then you get to fly back and then still enjoy all the pleasures of home too.
Very good. All right. As we move on, any other ideas about identity or fight to be productive when maybe it's not serving you as well?
I think productivity is good, but it really depends on people. Like I've learned that I'm an unusual in my desire to build and create stuff. Like I can't really go on vacation unless I'm doing something as part of the vacation, which is why I invented carpentourism. But not everyone needs that. So some people can have a lower level and still be happy, but just find your level. And if you find that you're feeling like uninspired and unmotivated, then you might want to experiment with adding some productivity to your life or to your days, especially as a retired person, because you don't have the work taking care of that productivity for you. And that's kind of what I think of as purpose. People say you need a purpose, but what that really translates to isn't just sitting with your hand on your heart saying like, I am a so-and-so, that's my purpose. You know, like purpose means doing stuff with your day. So as long as you have something that you're passionate about doing that preferably accomplishes something or helps other people in some way, that's what I would think of as productivity. And like if you're a parent, again, I keep returning to the parenting theme, but like that's a huge job of purpose and productivity. It might take 20 years of your life where your purpose is partly, a large part is just making these little beings grow up and have the needs taken care of, which is like a great, perfectly useful thing to do as your main activity.
We have a couple quick hit questions that are just for you, Pete. So this one's from Dan. He says, I listened to the recent episode with Mr. Money Mustache. You mentioned using margin. Can you explain how you use it and any tips and tricks for using margin accounts correctly? And I have never done this, so I will defer to you.
Oh, well, first of all, everybody who has a fair amount of investment account that's not in a retirement account should consider and learn about what margin borrowing is, because it's really a way that you can basically issue yourself a loan against your own savings with like no red tape and at the very best interest rate possible, as long as you have the right brokerage. So the best thing, I mean, I wrote it all out in a blog article, and I think the blog article is called How to Make a $400,000 Impulse Purchase, which now sounds so quaint because that's back when houses cost only $400,000. But anyway, and I learned about that from another friend who is ahead of me on the curve of the financial knowledge in that area. So I wrote the article. The basics are if you own a chunk of money, you can borrow up to half of that pretty safely in order to buy something, and then you pay it back on your own terms. And the stocks that you own, the index funds preferably that you own, are like the collateral on the loan. And it's very similar to getting a home equity line of credit, which a lot of people have heard of, which is where you take out a second mortgage on your house, or if you have no mortgage, that's even better. And then you can write checks against it and pay it back on your own schedule. And the real reason it's magic is that you don't have to do like this whole application process for the loan when you want to borrow. Like it's already pre-approved. You just write the check or make the electronic funds transfer to buy something. And I'm about to do that again. When I buy my next house sometime in the next year, I'm hoping to just borrow the entire value of the house against my one biggest investment account and buy this house in cash. Usually gets you a better deal on the house. And then it'll be basically a mortgage of my own money. And I can either choose to pay it back with future earnings. What I'll probably do is sell my current house, and that will pay back most of the balance. But this way I don't have to sell my current house before I buy the new house. So that kind of stuff. It's like super financial flexibility is the real story of the margin loan. And certain brokerages are better at offering this. Strangely enough, Robinhood has now started offering really good margin loan rates. So people no longer have to do what I did, which is I got this really hard to use brokerage called Interactive Brokerage. You no longer have to get an IBKR account. You can just get a Robinhood account. And if you have enough money in there, you can borrow against it on margin.
One follow-up. What's the downside here? So I'll get you started, right? So the collateral is your equities, right? It's your stock. And then if the value goes down, then all of a sudden, instead of borrowing 50%, well, that's 100% of it if it drops by a certain amount. So what's the issue?
You have to be very careful not to overdo it on the margin borrowing. And I mentioned this in the article too. So they let you borrow up to 50%, which in the worst case of like a 50% stock market crash, like we had in the year 2009, then you potentially could just lose all your money because the margin, the brokerage is very heartless where they say, well, you can borrow up to half, but if the stock market goes down below the certain limit, we're going to automatically sell all of your shares at the half price to get our money back. So that way our risk is gone. And then you have no shares left and you still owe us $500,000 or whatever you spent on your new house. So it's basically, it's like your money got exploded.
Right.
But that can never happen if you keep your borrowing safe enough. So like, let's say I borrow only 25%, let's say at $1 million of investment and I borrow 250 against it. And then there's a crazy once in a lifetime stock market crash of 50%. Well, I'm still way above the limit before this explosive catastrophic trigger of the automatic selling of my shares happens. So that's, and I mentioned this in the article, it's like stay within the safe limits just in case there's a 50% overnight stock market crash, and then you don't have to worry about it.
Yep. And as always, this is entertainment. This is not financial, legal, or any kind of advice. Yeah. So we'll link up to the blog post so people could do more research. Next one from Anna in the Facebook group. Can we crowdsource a cul-de-sac-like development in Colorado? I'm planning to move home to Longmont before too long and would love to invest. And I think a little tongue-in-cheek, but any ideas? Like, is that even possible to have like a cul-de-sac-like environment around here?
Yeah, that's such a neat idea. Well, first of all, to explain to people, cul-de-sac is a apartment community, basically a really nice apartment complex in Tempe, Arizona, near the university, that's been made by these people who are passionate about car-free living. So it's, on the surface, it looks just like a nice apartment complex with a lot of community spaces like patios and gardens and stuff. And you came and visited there once with a bunch of friends when it was still like early in this development. And the key is that it's on a light rail line, and they give you an e-bike when you join as a leaser so that you can bike around to stuff. The main idea is that I wanted to take from it is I like to live near sociable people I'm friends with. I want to live near my friends. And I think that's what Anna is mentioning, what she wants to do. So the answer is, yeah, if you had enough people, the best way to do it in real life would be to just buy a bunch of houses that happen to be near each other, or like everybody get apartments in one really nice apartment complex so that you live near your friends. And that's a really good way to do it because there's no red tape. You don't have to get permission from the city to build this whole new thing that they might not want you to build. Is like work within existing laws and rules and live near your friends, and that's probably good enough. Mm-hmm. If you do happen to be a billionaire, then definitely talk to me because at that level of scale, that's when you can make real things happen because you'd like buy like a 500-acre plot that's outside of an existing town so they don't have their stupid rules and red tape on you, and you found a new town with your own rules and you have like, you know, lawyers on staff that can do all anything, take care of making it all run smoothly. And then you build the housing the way you want to do, and you can build it all out without concern for like market forces, and you invite people and sell the houses at whatever price you want. And you make the bike paths and the car or no car aspect, however you like it. And I think that'd be really cool. And there's some communities that are actually doing that here and there, some run by literal billionaires and some that are trying to do it within, you know, with smaller budgets. Like there's one called Esmeralda in Northern California, that's super interesting. That's in progress.
Cool.
So yeah, but the easiest thing is just to move somewhere where you already know lots of friends, and that's really already a good enough recipe. And then choose to hang out with your friends a lot.
For the billionaires that are listening, let me know. Number one, would love to be friends with you. But I'll put you in touch with Pete, and then we could work on this thing together.
Yeah,
yeah, you're invited on the show. You could buy this podcast if you want to. It's for sale. I'll keep posting it. I don't know. There's probably a few out there in the audience. It'll be crazy if someone does contact us and they're like, yeah, actually listen to the show.
Yeah, we came close to something else. So I have another friend who has this really nice parcel of land that's near Austin, Texas. Uh-huh. And it's like 288 acres all in one parcel with like a mountain in the middle of it. And it's super gorgeous. And it's on a riverside and you can walk to a grocery store from there. And we were originally going to develop that into an intentional community with his help, because he's like a longtime Texas land developer. He's flipped lots of lands for tens of millions of dollars, but it got sidetracked by family and interesting dramas. Mm-hmm. We never went ahead with that, but I was pretty excited at the time because it really had everything that we need. Like it had the wealth and the ownership. Like this guy wasn't going to have to borrow money in order to make stuff happen. He just owned it already. There's no banks to beg for permission. Mm-hmm. We could just start building it. So I'm kind of sad when I think about that, how it didn't happen. But anyone else who owns like a good piece of land, free and clear, has the option of making an intentional community on it. And I'm surprised it doesn't happen more often. I think there just aren't enough intersection of like urban planning nerds and people with enough money to do stuff the right way, which is like ownership,
right,
rather than begging for permission from like little red tape.
Yeah.
You know, NIMBY councils.
Yeah. All right, last one here. So John from the Facebook group says, I read on your blog that you like to mountain bike. Have you tried a gravel bike or have you done any bike packing or anything like that?
I've certainly ridden these gravel bikes, which are just like, to me, not as fun as mountain bikes.
Mm.
Okay. Because I like the, I don't like riding on a flat gravel road. I like riding on like epic, steep, bumpy trails where, you know, and you're flying half the time. So I like the big tires and the suspension of a mountain bike. But I like this idea of the bike packing. It's a cool idea. I've never tried it.
Okay.
I highly respect people who do it.
Yeah.
But so far, just living so close to the mountains, I just take the bike and then I come home and eat and sleep in my own bed.
Very good. All right. Well, that wraps up the episode. And I think we could come back to a few of these. Great conversation, Pete. It's always fun when you join me in the studio here.
Thanks. And I can't believe that was an hour according to the clock up here.
Flies by. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So if people want to ask questions for some upcoming episodes, be sure you join the email list. We'll put a link so that you can get to it. Usually what happens if I plan far enough ahead, I will ask for questions from the email list so people can hop on there. And anything you want to plug for this episode, I didn't check with you ahead of time, but anything new going on? You got any blog posts coming up or anything like that?
No, I think we'll keep everything just like it'll come out whenever it comes out. But I do like the idea, like because of the coaching I've been doing, you know, maybe we could do like really short case studies from the mailbag. If somebody has like a compelling question, we're not going to like make a spreadsheet and go through it in the podcast, but you know, there might be some simple like principles that can be expressed that are useful to people that come up in these case studies.
Yeah, that's perfect. I like that. All right. So yeah, join the email list so that you'll know when we're soliciting these case studies and stories and stuff like that. We'll link up to previous episodes and all that. And thanks a lot, Pete.
Thank you, Doug.
Thanks for listening to the show. That was the Mile High Five podcast, and I'm Doug Cunnington. If you dig the show, please do three things for us. Number one, tell a friend, a family member, an enemy about the show. We really don't care who you tell. Maybe forward them a specific show that you know that they will like. It's the single most helpful thing that you can do to spread the word. It's like giving us a virtual high five, and actually we don't give high fives in person, so the virtual kind's pretty good. And more importantly, your friend or family member or even your enemy will appreciate the fact that you were thinking of them. Number two, make sure you're following or subscribed on your podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, YouTube, whatever you're using, and that way you won't miss a show. And number three, please leave us a rating and review. We read them on the show occasionally, and you might hear yours out there on an upcoming episode. Quick disclaimer. This show is not financial or legal advice. I'd actually be surprised if it sounded like it. It's really just for entertainment, and that's at least what we're hoping for. But seriously, get advice from professionals. So we'll catch y'all next week. I've been riding with Carl a little more often. I don't have my truck anymore, so I don't have the V8 truck.
Awesome.
You're always so kind to never make fun of me that I had it, and I appreciate that. But I finally got rid of it. Carl likes driving his car, and he uses the full self-drive on his Model Y, and FSD for short. I rode with him like right when he first got the car, and he was testing it out. And there have been many upgrades, and the thing is, it's so good now. It's very, very good. He'll pull out of the driveway. The farthest that we went was Breckenridge. So like he like turned it on, and I think he had to intervene just like one time, but lately it's just been like flawless. It has figured out some really cool stuff. So you have a Model Y as well, but do you use the FSD?
I click on the subscription sometimes to see how they're doing with the progress. I have an older version of that same car than Carl does, so it'll never drive quite as well as the newest version because the computer is different in there. But it's still impressive. Like, it drives well. It's better than most human drivers, even in the older version. And I'm just too much of a control freak, though, so that's the main reason I don't use it. So I use this lower but still awesome feature that comes with every Tesla. It's called Autopilot, and that just keeps you in your lane, and it drives, you know, even if it's a curvy mountain road, and it responds to the other traffic appropriately.
Okay.
But the thing that it doesn't do is try to change lanes, because to me, changing lanes is an art. And like, you know, every lane change should have like an essay behind it. Like, well, I was considering, but then that guy was coming up, but I have to merge in 2 miles. However, this truck has been behaving erratically. And like, there's like a whole thing before you decide on a lane change. And even like the smartest Teslas, they kind of just change lanes arbitrarily. Like, this guy's going slow, so I'm changing lanes. You can't just change lanes willy-nilly like that. There has to be some thought put into it.
Right.
So that kind of stuff.
I'm with you. That's very interesting. Yeah. So one thing that I have a new experience with, I rented a car for a road trip, and I have been trying to rent a Tesla to just experience it, not for the FSD or anything like that, but to test one out. However, I've been traveling to places that aren't as friendly for EVs. So yeah, going through Wyoming and South Dakota, the chargers are not as plentiful as they are in other places. So I was like, probably not a good option. However, I did rent, I think it was a Camry hybrid, and it got like 50 miles to the gallon, which is pretty good, way better than my old truck was. And it did have some steering assist and then the adaptive cruise control. So it actually steered pretty well through those windy roads. And I was like, this is decent for, I had very low expectations.
Yeah.
Nowhere close to FSD and like what.
And that's what keeps Toyota in business, is like, people are used to really basic gas cars, and then Toyota is adding a tiny upgrade. And the people who don't know about what electric cars are like, especially Teslas, they're like, wow, way to go, Toyota.
Right.
But for the rest of us, it's like, wow, these cars are like, they're from 1971 compared. Like, it's so ridiculous how much better electric cars are. But I'm still glad that everybody's getting more fuel efficient and better than nothing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you guys have been a good influence, because I'm like, oh, I know there's some learning curve that I will have to figure out, especially like with renting, right? Because if I bought an EV, then I would figure it out quick and I would do more research. But I mean, like
what you mentioned, Wyoming, like, to a Tesla owner, there's plenty of chargers in Wyoming. Like, you just say, drive to Seattle, and it's planned out, and you'll be stopping at Tesla chargers, like perfectly spaced along your route. It's all like figured out right down to the minute. And it's like, yeah, you're going to stop at Casper, Wyoming for 18 minutes, and we're going to charge from 11 to 88%, and then we're going to continue.
Right.
And which is actually way easier than a gas car, because gas car, you're like, oh, we're getting low. Oh, that sign says there's gas at the next exit. Okay, let's take that next one. You're like, it's totally crude in 1971 style compared to, like, electric car, or Tesla specifically. Like, they're the only ones that have this cross the country without thinking about it, and the charging's taken care of for you. It's funny how that's not well known, except for among the,
right,
you know, the Tesla nerds who are like, what are you talking about, road trips? It's easier.
So the one, and then we'll end it here, because we could, again, like normal, we could do a whole episode on this. Mm-hmm. And maybe we'll invite Carl in, because you guys could just, you talk all day on this. But in Yellowstone National Park, there are chargers at each of the main hotels. However, they're not as fast. It's not on the supercharger system. Is that what you call it? Superchargers?
Yeah.
And you often don't have cell phone service in the park. So for my first experience, I was like, there's a couple yellow flags that would make this not as fun for me. Yeah. So I opted for something different in that case. But point is well taken. There are chargers around. You can make it work. But I was like, for my virgin voyage, not the best decision. So
yeah, true.